You're listening to Live from Lord North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Here in the UK, we hear a great deal about the Donald Trump administration, but how do we get past the hyperbole and hysteria to figure out what's really going on across the pond? Today we're joined by Dr. Tom Palmer, a senior fellow at the Cato Institute in Washington and vice president for international programs at the Atlas Network. Interviewed by the IEA's news editor Kate Andrews, Tom discusses the president's modus operandi, his top priorities, and the internal workings of the White House. They evaluate the success of Donald Trump's tax reforms and whether his reluctance to make common cause with Democrats may make it more likely that these reforms will ultimately be overturned. Finally, they examine his policies on immigration and trade and his America First approach. If you like what you hear, be sure to subscribe to our iTunes channel, IEA Conversations.
Tom, thanks so much for joining me today. You've come over from the States, and here in the UK, we get just as many sensationalist headlines about what's going on in American politics at the moment, but they don't necessarily pop into the news every single day. So I think some people in the UK are still a bit in the dark as to what's really going on in America. How are people feeling? You know, are they feeling positive? Are they feeling negative? Is the country moving in the right direction or the wrong one?
I'd have to say that if people in the UK feel they're in the dark, they're not alone. This is also true in the United States because there's no discernible pattern to the policies of the administration. It's just one incoherent impulse after another, just to be frank. We can distinguish between changes on the policy front and changes in public opinion. Those are not always intimately connected. People often respond to whether they have a job and is income going up and so on. And as a matter of fact, the U.S. economy is doing rather well right now. I don't give Mr. Trump or Mr. Obama the credit. This is a recovery that's been going on for quite some time. But naturally, politicians always claim credit for any good news that happens when they happen to be in office. But in general, I think most people think that the economy is headed in the right direction. But there's a great deal of worry about what to expect next. Will the president wake up in a good mood or a bad mood? And what will his Twitter feed say? Remember, this is a president who fired his Secretary of State by tweet, without having announced it to him or discussed it with him. And this is how policies are being set right now in the United States. So it's a roller coaster ride.
And those policies are a mixed bag, aren't they? I think there was a lot of good stuff that came out of the Republican tax cuts that were passed late last year. So you can see the economy is getting a bit of a boost from that. People are getting bonuses. A lot of companies have reported that they've given wage increases because of it. So those tax cuts seem to be a good thing on the surface. Also, a lot of regulation reportedly is being rolled back. But at the same time, we're seeing some very intrusive policies coming from the government around topics like immigration, around tariffs, and the president boasting about trade wars. So if you could break that down a bit for us and tell us, you know, how that's benefiting the American economy and the global economy, but also how it's impacting it poorly.
Well, we should remember this is a president who publicly said trade wars are good and they're easy to win. This tells us something about his depth of understanding of international trade. Mm. But let's go back to the good news. I don't think it's as good as some people might have seen it. The changes in tax policy that were passed by a Republican Congress, it's the Congress, not the president, who writes tax policy. And any Republican Congress would have put out some kind of tax reform. I haven't read the entire bill. I don't know any human being who has. I do know people who have read big parts of it. And the general sense among serious economists is that it represented an improvement. Rates were brought down, and very important on corporate taxation, they turned toward a territorial principle like other countries in the world have. This is something everybody knew should be done. What concerns me is because of the intense polarization, there was not a single Democratic vote in support of these. This is so different from what happened under President Reagan, where he actually talked to the other party, and there were other sponsors in the Democratic Party for those Reagan tax reforms. There was no one from the other side. The polarization is very deep, and Mr. Trump loves this. He promotes it at every moment, demonizing his opponents and being unwilling to sit down and have a rational conversation with them. That means this is just more likely to be rolled back if the Congress changes hands. The spending side, we think about taxing and spending, there's no constraint. They've passed a staggering increase in spending. In one bill, they raised it 13% in 1 year. massive increases in military spending, but also domestic non-military spending, going to various favored special interests that they view as part of their coalition. So the spending is just out of control. The tax reforms were rational, and there were lots of Democrats who knew that, but not one of them was willing to come on board. This is not a good sign for the long term. Let's turn to regulation. I don't think that the news is as good as they have trumpeted it, but it is nonetheless a good thing. The Obama administration has seen a staggering increase in interventions into private business affairs that have very high compliance costs. This is the thing they never talk about. Oh, it's a good thing. Make sure companies do this and this and this and this, with no concern about how much it costs, how many accountants and control and compliance officers, how much paperwork you have to bear to fulfill the reporting and other regulatory requirements. And that's largely come to a halt. And I think it's a very good thing. There's been almost no rollback on the regulatory front. They promised we'll undo one for every new one. But the fact is that the accumulated increase in regulatory burden has been so huge, this is an insignificant drop in the burden. The good news is they're not making it heavier, but they're not, in fact, making it substantially lighter. Nonetheless, I'll take that. I'm happy to see this.
Any improvement.
This is definitely an improvement overall, but not as much as they have trumpeted. When you look at the savings due to the very modest regulatory rollbacks to the economy, they're a drop in the bucket compared to the massive multi-trillion dollar burden in just compliance costs alone. Let's then go to trade, where the policies are simply incoherent. We have State Department saying one thing, Treasury Department saying another thing, the Commerce Department saying something else, and then the President tweets something new. There's no obviously coherent policy, and they have mixed in matters of foreign and military policy with trade policy. So take the obvious example, the sanctions on the Chinese electronics firm ZTE. They had been caught violating the sanctions with regard to Iran and North Korea with dual-use technology. If you think it's a good thing to sanction them or not, that's one matter. But the fact is, they broke the law. They were sanctioned. And so these sanctions said that they could not import high-tech goods from the United States. All right? The president says, oh, in order to create more jobs with China and work out some better deal, I'm going to lift that.
No regard for the rules.
There are no rules. Mm. There just are no rules at all. It's completely incoherent. And recognize also, I think this is just a train wreck on a trade policy, that our Secretary of Commerce, he's a businessman who handles wheeling and dealing and taking over steel companies and so on. He knows nothing of international trade, nothing of international trade accounting. He defended Trump's protectionist and mercantilist policies in the Wall Street Journal. He said, it's Econ 101. Everybody knows that gross domestic product is equal to consumption plus investment plus government plus exports minus imports. Minus imports. He sees his job as reducing imports to the United States of America, not understanding this is not a formula for economic growth. It's an accounting identity. The reason you subtract out imports is because they're already counted in consumption. We consume them in government expenditure and in investment. Companies bring in products that are part of the components of what they produce. So this was just shocking. He thinks his job is to reduce imports in the United States of America. This man's ignorance is simply invincible. And here he is, the Secretary of Commerce.
The obsession that the Trump administration seems to have with the concept of trade deficits is rather baffling. No understanding that as you have cheaper imports coming into your country, that costs are going down for consumers, and that the average American is obviously going to enjoy that very much. So obsessed with this idea that America needs to be exporting more regardless of the economic impact.
Well, let me just mention, it's even dumber than the way you've just presented it. That's a very serious side of it. But he doesn't understand that when he trumpeted an increase in foreign investment in the United States, it means an increase in the trade deficit. Mm-hmm. When the capital account surplus goes up, it means your trade deficit goes up as well. The utter incoherence. He thinks we should have a trade surplus with every country in the world. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not really possible. It's just a crazy goal. The entire trade policy is just being driven by a mixture of ignorance and impulse.
How do you think people in the UK should be feeling about the possibility of getting a free trade agreement with the US? Obviously, President Obama, during the European Union referendum, said that Britain would be at the back of the queue if it voted to leave. Donald Trump came out with very different positions, saying that you would be at the front of the queue. But as you point out, it's hard to know on a day-to-day basis which way the winds are going to blow and in which direction Mr. Trump is going to move his policies. Do you think it's possible that in a few years' time, Britain could have a free trade agreement with the US?
Of course, it's possible. I don't think that people have quite grasped how complicated these matters are. It would be nice to have a free trade agreement that was just one page, but in the world of the modern regulatory state, this is not going to happen. These trade agreements are often very long and complicated because there are questions of health and safety standards, of port clearance rules, compliance with all of the different policies of the British and American governments regarding sanctions on other countries, and on and on and on and on. And the idea that he could just wave a pen and make one is a fantasy. This is how he likes to think about the world, but it's not going to happen. So in my opinion, the idea of a bilateral trade agreement between the UK and the US, well, it's possible. I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. It's much more complicated than he has suggested or has any idea of. And all of the protectionist groups that want to keep out British goods will be right there lobbying. And by the way, same thing here in the UK. And Mr. Trump has never met a special interest he didn't like, if that group was willing to support him. And so we can expect just a cascade of special exemptions and so on from his office and from the office of the U.S. Trade Representative.
It's interesting how the concept of lobbying groups or special interest groups has changed, or shall I say expanded, to include a new type of person, which I would call the celebrity. I think this really started under Barack Obama. I would actually argue he was our first celebrity president in the sense that he was a sitting president taking part in late night talk shows. He really played up that side with the media and with Hollywood and his connections there. And he hosted lots of celebrities and was seen as sort of this much cooler president who was in touch with a lot of very famous people. Trump has expanded that, but arguably, you know, is the reality TV star in many ways. And I think that's trickling into our news, I would argue, in a more negative way. But just recently, he's met with Kim Kardashian to discuss prison reform. Now, I suspect that you and I will probably like a lot of what she had to say and what they discussed about taking nonviolent offenders out of prison and helping people to rehabilitate. But I'm also concerned that special interest now, it has such a broader definition, and that certain people have access to the president and have his ear that have no training in policy, that have no background in the nuances that go into this decision making, and yet the president's listening to them.
Yeah, what more can I say? I don't believe in rule by elites. I do believe in citizen participation and that everyday normal people have a right to have a voice in politics. But when it comes to sometimes technical matters of law and economics, I think that having expertise matters. When I am asked my opinion on some legal matter, my normal response is to say, you need to talk to a lawyer about that. Don't follow my seat of the pants advice on these matters. Lawyers are there for a reason. They went to school for a long time, learned about the law, and you should go to them. Same thing with medical advice and so on. Now, citizens have the right to express their opinion. There's no question, but technical matters about trade negotiations or about the law, for example, you do want to go to expertise. And the president seems utterly contemptuous. He kept saying he has the best brain, he has the best words, remarkable boast. He knows everything, and he doesn't need to ask anyone else for their opinion. And when they contradict him, as for instance with General McMaster, he gets rid of them. He insults them, and then he tosses them out. He can't stand being around anyone who actually knows anything, because he is possibly one of the most ignorant creatures to occupy the White House, certainly in my entire life. And so real expertise is dismissed. I think when it comes to military and diplomatic policy and the technical details of trade policy and legal policy, it's a good idea to have some expertise.
So, Tom, you travel the U.S. and indeed the world, speaking to people who are campaigning for freedom and liberty, listening to their stories, hearing what's happening on the ground. What are you excited about in America? Where do you see things really changing? Where do you find the hope and where do you find the inspiration?
Well, more Democrats are coming up for free trade.
That's true, and freedom of speech, and they seem to be much more interested in the Constitution, I would argue, than they were, say, years ago.
Well, I think they're interested in limits on executive power, but this is an example of pure opportunism.
Mm-hmm.
Let me paint the picture. Maybe isn't quite as rosy as you were expecting from me. We heard President Obama bypass checks and balances in the separation of powers openly and blatantly. When the Congress would not pass things that he supported, and so they're saying, well, we have a divided government and checks and balances and separation of powers. He said, I have a pen and I have a telephone. I'll just do these things anyway. This is really an assault on the constitutional order. And very few people on the Democratic side of the aisle or the, let's say, center-left and political discourse raised any objections to this at all. Well, now someone else inherited that power. And he's trying to do the same thing. And suddenly they discover the idea of the separation of powers. I wish that there were some more principle in this regard. It's something that I've stressed for many years with whether they're Democrats, Republicans, or left or right. Don't propose and support a state power, an authority on the part of the president or Congress that you would be unhappy seeing in the hands of your political opponents. And yet it seems very difficult for people to understand that very fundamental point. They say, well, we're in power now, so we should have all of this authority and power. Well, what happens when you're not? And the other side has it. Would you be happy then? And if not, you should not support that increase in state power or the authority of an office. So a great deal of this, I think, is highly opportunistic. I would like to see a greater revival of real principle support for limited government, for the separation of powers, for free enterprise, and so on. And I'm afraid at the moment I'm not seeing very much of this. The Republican Party is ceasing to be even a cartoon version of a free enterprise limited government party. And the Democratic Party, unfortunately, is now veering toward the far left in the form of Senator Sanders and Senator Warren. So I'm very concerned about the future of American politics. Now, let me go a little bit further south in Mexico. The Mexican presidential elections are coming up, and López Obrador is the far-left populist candidate. He's the mirror image of Trump. He's like Trump in so many regards, but on the left rather than, well, frankly, wherever it is that Trump is. I'm not sure where we would put him. Every time Trump tweets, he goes up in the polls.
Mm-hmm.
Because Trump issues one insult after another against Mexicans as people, against the Mexican government, against Mexican culture, so on and on and on. And this fuels an anti-American rhetoric in Mexico. And so we may see an explicit Chavista, supporter of Hugo Chavez, Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela, someone who's been very close to the Castro dictatorship in Cuba, becoming president of Mexico. Thank you very much, President Trump, for doing this. And if that happens, we will hear anti-American rhetoric coming out of the Mexican government and more anti-Mexican rhetoric coming out of the American government. And nothing good will come of this, nothing good at all. It's already having a negative impact on border trade. A trade across the border with Mexico is very important, not only for the United States as a whole, but for the towns and communities and states along the Mexican border. And this is already being negatively impacted by this rise of extremist, nationalist, and very ugly rhetoric on both sides of the border.
And it's such an unnecessary feud when you consider how well assimilation has gone between Mexicans and Americans at the south of the border over the years. I mean, you had George Bush Sr. and Ronald Reagan debating about who was more pro-immigration because they saw the benefits that Mexican culture had on the U.S. The president really is creating this feud out of absolutely nowhere.
Well, I think in his case, it was viewed as playing to a certain electoral base that would respond affirmatively to it. But it's not even just a question of immigration, just trade across the border. Mm. It's quite massive, and this is another thing that the mercantilists don't understand. There's no such thing anymore as an American car or an American airplane or American this or that. The components come from all over the world, and many of them do come from Mexico or from Canada, and quite often these goods go back and forth across the border multiple times as additional components are added or as they're refined. It's a bit like saying, oh, this is a Manchester product, or this is a product of Wales or what have you. There are things go across parts of Britain. The components are made in one place and assembled in another place. And the same thing is true within the United States and across those borders. So he's taking action, like let's take in the case of automobile tariffs that he's been threatening, that's very harmful to automobile production in the United States. He complains, why don't I see more Ford and Chrysler cars out there? Well, you should think about the cars that are produced in the United States. Here's some American car companies that manufacture in the U.S. Honda in Greenberg, Indiana, and in Marysville, Ohio, Nissan, Smyrna, Tennessee, Toyota, Georgetown, Kentucky, BMW in Spartanburg, South Carolina. They produce huge amounts of cars. They add value to the American economy. They provide gainful employment. But for Trump, they're foreign car makers.
Mm-hmm. And what you're tapping into, Tom, which is so important, is that we've gone back to the 101 debate really here on capitalism and globalization. And it's being fought here in the UK as well. The Labour Party has gone far to the left. The leader, Jeremy Corbyn, is a self-proclaimed socialist, has had many sympathies with similar regimes that you've just mentioned in South America over the years. I mean, a very far left way of thinking. And a lot of it comes down to protectionism and nationalism and the rejection of the way that the world has moved, this global enterprise that we are now all living in, and they demonize it. And I suppose the responsibility is now back on us to prove to the world yet again how globalism and capitalism rise people out of poverty, make the world a more prosperous place. We need to remind people the benefits that they get from such systems.
I should add, in Jeremy Corbyn's case, anti-Semitism as well.
Indeed.
And indeed, people have often identified Jews with business and capitalism, mm-hmm. and this has been a kind of double whammy.
There's been some ugly stuff in the Labour Party recently.
Yeah, very disturbing. But the fact of the matter is that these people don't understand what it is to engage in the creation of wealth, of the creation of value. Not only work can produce value, but also trade. Just trade by itself creates additional value in the world. And these people don't understand it. They're living in a kind of Neanderthal understanding of economics. In fact, the Neanderthals were more advanced than that. Archaeology has shown that they had the stone implements and so on that were traded over large distances. We need an economy that is open to innovation. We need an economy that is open to enterprise, and that means competition also. And the competition can come from a Canadian firm or a Mexican firm or American or Peruvian or British or German or what have you. The point is that we should respect the free choices of people to buy and sell what they want. The other side of this debate is really about, in their view, dividing up a fixed pie. We should be focused on making that pie grow so that more people can enjoy rising standards of living. And the other thing that's most important and needs to be discussed or raised is peace, because trade encourages peace. There's an old adage that has been shown to be true in empirical studies time and time again. If goods do not cross borders, armies will. If you support a peaceful world, you must support freedom of trade. It's a moral imperative.
Thank you so much for joining me, Tom.
It's my pleasure.
For more podcasts, blogs, reports, and films, go to our website, iea.org.uk.